Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, New Jersey is bearing the brunt of climate change in the Northeast, according to a new study. Climatologist Dave Robinson will tell us what this means. Also, some state lawmakers want to sue Big Oil over its role in global warming. And if you adopted a dog or cat during the pandemic, how's it going? Nancy Urban of the Animal Welfare Association in Voorhees will be along with expert advice, and we'll be taking your calls and comments at 888-477-9499. But first, when the gravity of the unfolding coronavirus pandemic started sinking in back in March, state and federal officials scrambled to put programs together aimed at keeping small businesses from going under. The programs helped many, but not all. A low-interest loan program launched by Pennsylvania Governor Wolf was quickly drained by business owners who were able to get their paperwork in with lightning speed. And when the program closed after just a handful of days, a large number of firms found themselves standing on the sidelines empty-handed, many of them minority-owned. Now, a new grant program seeks to help Pennsylvania's most vulnerable businesses stay on track. Charlotte Keith has been reporting on this for Spotlight PA, and she joins us now with details. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi.
Let's get a little history before we get to the new program. The original low-interest loan program offered by the Wolf administration set aside $61 million for small businesses. This was back, I think, in March, and as you report, Charlotte, the money was gone in less than a week. How were over 700 businesses able to race to the front of the line and get their applications in and even approved so quickly? Do we know?
Well, it really depended on where those businesses were in the state. The way this worked, you know, to get these applications done as soon as possible, the state relied on this network of nonprofit economic development organizations spread across the state to add manpower. And the idea was these organizations would review the applications and then pass them on to the state for final approval. But the problem was, with such a crush of demand and with the funding being allocated on a first-come, first-served basis, some counties had several of these organizations. Some just had one. One county didn't even have one at all. And so these organizations ended up being able to give very different numbers of applications to the state in the time they had. And so that meant that businesses in some counties had a much better shot at getting their application in time to get some of the money than businesses in some other places.
So with a little bit more of a narrow focus, why were so many minority-owned businesses left out?
Well, it seems there are probably two main reasons for that. And I just want to clarify, it's the number of minority-owned businesses who actually got the loan was pretty equivalent to the number who actually applied. So it's not that they were applying and being at some great disadvantage. It's more just that I think the program was rolled out very quickly, and there wasn't necessarily a huge focus on outreach and kind of publicizing it. And also just, again, that those geographic disparities, so that some bigger counties with more diverse populations weren't very well represented in the final totals of who got the loan.
Okay. How are minority-owned businesses faring in general in the pandemic?
Well, research suggests really not well, and that they are actually bearing a lot of the brunt of the economic fallout. And that's partly just because of the industries that they tend to be concentrated in, and also because they tend to be smaller.
The new program offers $200 million in grant money. What was the thinking behind switching from low-interest loans to grants, which do not have to be paid back, correct?
Yes. Well, I think part of it is that it would be more helpful and also more appealing to small business owners. A lot of business owners that I've spoken to have raised their concerns, whether they applied for the federal Paycheck Protection Loan Program or not, that, you know, even though those loans can be forgiven, it represents more debt, and a lot of people are reluctant to take on more debt at such a precarious time. And so with a grant, at least, you know, people have the peace of mind that they can get the grant, they can spend it on what they need it to, and they don't have to worry about how their business is going to be faring months down the line when they have to pay the loan back.
We are speaking with Charlotte Keith, investigative reporter with Spotlight PA. Charlotte, who is the new program prioritizing specifically what types of businesses, how big, how much revenue do they typically bring in over the course of a year?
Yeah, so the new program is very specifically targeted at the smallest and most vulnerable businesses. Specifically, it's only for businesses with 25 or fewer employees and less than $1 million in annual revenue. And half of the money is set aside for minority-owned businesses. Then within those, there's a kind of complicated scoring system that aims to give priority to the businesses who have lost the most money because of the virus and those in poor or rural areas.
Let's get into the application process itself, which is very different than that of the original loan programs in both the state and federal levels. The grant program is not first come, first serve, to my understanding.
Right. Yes, that's right.
Okay. So how does it work then?
Well, so the way that it works is there are going to be several kind of application windows during which businesses can get the applications in. And then each time those are closed, all the applications get scored and ranked on those priorities. And then a certain number get the grants each time. And so that gives businesses at least some more calm in the sense that they're not, you know, scrambling to be the first at the front of the line. And it also means that there's more time for, you know, word of the program to spread. So even for small business owners now who weren't able to apply the first time around, there will be another application window opening at some point this month. And so it's not too late for business owners who haven't tried yet.
The application process is entirely online, so internet access is a must. This is not a given for some businesses, is it?
Right. And that's something that you know, people I spoke to for my story said, you know, they understood that's a concern, but that it was important just in terms of the ease of handling thousands and thousands of applications, that if those were coming in on paper, it would take much longer to process them, and it would be harder to do the scoring in a kind of uniform way. There is help available for business owners who want to apply but have trouble with internet access, or who want someone to walk them through the process through these community development financial institutions. There are 17 across the state, and they are all helping business owners get their applications in for this program.
And these CDFIs, this process, again, is a little different than the original process in terms of outreach, you know, comparing the original state loan program and the grant program.
Yes. These CDFIs are nonprofit small business lenders that typically work with businesses and communities who can't get, you know, traditional bank loans. And so this is kind of what they do under normal circumstances anyway. So the thinking was that they would be very well positioned to publicize this program, to encourage business owners to apply, and to be there to help them in ways that, you know, the state just by itself wouldn't be able to, or traditional commercial lenders might not be inclined to.
Charlotte, many minority business owners don't trust the system. This is what I've gotten from a number of articles. You spoke with Karen Sawyer, a Black business owner in York, who didn't apply for a grant during the first application window a few weeks ago. She says she figured she wouldn't get it anyway. Why did she feel this way?
Well, I think like a lot of business owners, she just feels overwhelmed by the variety of programs that are available, but they all come with effort. It's to apply for any of these, you know, you have to understand the rules, you have to understand the terms, you have to do the application. And certainly I think there are small business owners who just aren't sure sometimes if it's worth the effort. And like you said, some people do feel disenchanted with these systems and, you know, not sure if it's worth it for them. I think certainly for Karen Sawyer, she had not a great experience applying for a paycheck protection loan the first time, and she did eventually get one, but the whole thing was just, I think, a big hassle for her. And so, you know, she was saying really what she would like is just to be able to get back to work and to rely on herself and not have to be seeking this kind of outside help.
Tell us a little bit about her business.
So she owns a event venue in the York Galleria Mall called the Party Palooza. It's sort of an all-service event venue where you can go and there's, you know, decorations and food. And it opened at a very, you know, in retrospect, a very bad time. She was renovating it through the winter, and then the venue opened in March, just about a week and a half before the governor's statewide shutdown order went into effect, and it had to close. And so, you know, like a lot of business owners, Karen is now very uncertain about the future, hopeful that, you know, she can get back to work and try and get back on track. She's kind of pivoted some of the aspects of her business to do things more outside or to, you know, have events in a way that's more socially distanced. But certainly, I think it's been a very stressful and difficult experience for her.
And still not leaning toward trying to go for one of, for some grant money from the state?
As of right now, I don't think so. Yeah.
But there's still time because the second round of applications, I think, happens at some point this month, correct?
Yes, there definitely is still time. The second round of applications hasn't opened yet, but it's set to at some point in August. And I think, again, it will be, you know, a decently long application window that as long as you get your application in at some point during that time, you're okay. And even after that, I think the idea is that there will be further rounds even later on. So it's a very different approach than saying, you know, here's the pool of loans and, you know, it'll be gone in a week.
And this time around, Charlotte, applications are being reviewed by a third party, and doing it this way should get around some of the issues generated by the original loan program. Very quickly, how might this work, and why could it be more fair in the end?
Yeah, I think the idea was just that these CDFIs who are, you know, overseeing this program, their strength is not in reviewing thousands and thousands of applications quickly. Their strength is in outreach and helping small business owners. And so having a kind of centralized system like there is this time, it removes the possibility that, you know, like with the first loan program, some organizations just were able to churn through applications faster than others. So it just kind of takes that possibility off the table.
All right, Charlotte Keith, thanks for all the information. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlotte Keith is investigative reporter with Spotlight PA. Up next on the regional roundup, we're going to talk about New Jersey and why the Garden State is experiencing the effects of climate change more than its northeastern neighbors. New Jersey State Senator, I should say state climatologist David Robinson will be along on that. And then New Jersey State Senator Loretta Weinberg on the efforts to sue Big Oil for the damages caused by climate change. Some interesting information ahead. Stay with us for that on the Regional Roundup.
Welcome. Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to the regional roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. New Jersey is being hit hard by climate change, harder than its neighbors in the Northeast. According to a recent report from the State Department of Environmental Protection, average temperatures in the Garden State are up 3.5 degrees since 1895, and it's projected that warming could increase as much as 5.5 degrees by 2050. There will likely be more and longer heat waves and an increase in heat-related deaths. Higher amounts of precipitation are expected as well, which means more flooding, and all this as sea levels are rising. It is a stark assessment, and we've invited New Jersey State climatologist David Robinson to the roundup to help us understand why New Jersey is particularly vulnerable. Dave Robinson, good to speak with you again.
It's good to speak with you.
Let's tackle sea level rise first. According to the DEP, sea levels are increasing at a greater rate in New Jersey than in other parts of the world. Why?
Yeah, there's a couple of factors involved with that. One is simply the oceans are getting warmer and thermally expanding, and there is glacial ice that is melting that is filling the ocean tire. But along the Jersey coast, we also have some what's called subsidence. We're pumping water out of the ground, and there's actually some rebound from 10 to 20,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. So you put that all together, and sea level's risen about a foot and a half along the Jersey coast, which is a little higher than we find elsewhere around the world.
Well, what does this mean then for the viability of shore communities over the next, say, half century if climate change continues at the pace at which it's been moving?
Yeah. Over the next half century, we're talking about perhaps upwards of a foot rise in sea level. And with that, we're going to have to take more protective methods. Beach replenishment, which we've been doing for decades now, pay more attention to the dune fields in the back bays with bulkheads and such, and be prepared for a minor storm to provide as much flooding as perhaps a moderate or major storm did in the past. So there's a lot we can do in that scenario. It's what comes after that as we get to the end of this century, when the pace of sea level rise increases, that is going to be even more worrisome to the future of our coastal communities.
Hard to believe, but the 8th anniversary of Superstorm Sandy is this October. Is it likely we'll see more superstorms or even hurricanes in this area?
Well, that certainly was an eye-opener. And looking to the future, there's a lot of uncertainty with the number of storms that might impact the Atlantic Basin in general. But the fact is, as sea surface temperatures warm, we may find storms staying stronger as they come up the East Coast. So the prevailing thinking right now is there won't be more storms, but the storms that do impact us may be stronger than they were on average in the past. But we have more than that to worry about. There's just the typical nor'easter that comes through the cooler portion of the year and is more prevalent along the Jersey coast than a hurricane, although not necessarily with the devastating impacts of a direct hit of a hurricane.
Dave, we've had obviously a lot of 90-degree-plus days this past month. In a recent interview, you stated that 11 of the 15 warmest summers in New Jersey, going back to 1895, have happened in the last two decades. So if temperatures are up, say, by 5.5 degrees by 2050, what is the likely scenario as far as hot days in the summer is concerned?
Yeah, it's a real health concern. And the timing couldn't be better because New Jersey's past July, the July we just finished, was the warmest July, the warmest month of any month, going back 126 years of record in New Jersey. It was 4 degrees above the long-term average. So that should give you some idea of what we have to cope with the discomfort from the heat, the humidity, running our air conditioners more often if we have the availability of air conditioning, warmer nights in particular, and with that, health issues. So we're going to have to be more prepared to live in a climate more akin to the southeastern United States than elsewhere.
And this is all coming off a super mild winter this year. Are you ready to say this is climate change's calling card?
Oh, there's no question it is. 7 of the 9 warmest Julys in the last 126 years have occurred since 2010, for instance. And we can look at the same thing. You talked about the summers. June was our 10th warmest June on record. The first 4 months of this year all ranked in the top 10. We only had a little bit of a break in April and May, which were actually the first back-to-back below average months in over 2 years. So we're seeing the climate changing, and it's changing in every season.
Back to the heat of this past July, just briefly, I was reading in published reports this morning, there were no heat-related deaths in Philly, which was a good surprise. Is this a positive trend?
Well, yeah, that's wonderful news. As we become more aware of this and we have mechanisms in place to check on the elderly and keep everyone safer. The other thing about this heat, it's been more the persistence of the hot conditions rather than our 100, 102, 103 degree days. So we haven't had torrid days. We've just had persistently warm days into the 90s. And that may be a little bit of a help as well.
Why do you think we haven't had those 100 degree days in recent years?
Yeah, well, in part it's because we were so moist. And when you get a moist atmosphere, it actually can temper the hottest of the hot temperatures, but can certainly keep you warm during the day and particularly warm at night because you can't get rid of the daytime heat up through the atmosphere. It gets caught by all that moisture in the atmosphere. So it's a combination of moisture and just the weather patterns that didn't produce the hot, dry conditions, which sometimes send temperatures soaring above the century mark.
Dave Robinson, the pandemic, of course, has prompted something of a pause in the rate of carbon emissions. Will this have any effect on the progression of climate change, at least for the moment?
Generally not. There was still an upward trend. It's just trending upward a little bit more slowly in the first half of this year. But the overall pattern is one of increasing amounts of carbon dioxide entering the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases. So the slightest of not even a pause, but of a reduction in carbon emissions, but not enough to ultimately make a difference.
And again, once CO2 gets into the atmosphere, it takes a long time for it to leave the atmosphere.
Absolutely right. It's got a long residence time in the atmosphere. And I might add, the heat that gets into the atmosphere due to the increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually being, a lot of it's being transferred into the oceans. So only about 10% of the heat from the greenhouse warming is staying in the atmosphere. 90% is being absorbed by the oceans.
Which means that exacerbates the situation?
Yeah, and it also means it's a long-lasting situation that we're not going to be able to reverse, but we can ameliorate to some extent by burning fewer fossil fuels, using less energy. But the fact is, the train's left the station. It's just we can keep control of the speed of that train a little bit as we go into the future. At least that would be the hope.
Okay, one more quick question for you, about 30 seconds. What do you think about technologies being developed to pull carbon out of the air? Promising solutions?
It's one solution. I like to say that we were smart enough to engineer ourselves into this situation. Perhaps we can use some of that ingenuity to help get us out of it. Right now, it's not energy practical, so we better not look in that direction and only that direction. We really need to reduce our carbon footprint.
All right. Dave Robinson, good to hear from you.
A pleasure. Anytime.
David Robinson is New Jersey's state climatologist. Well, Big Tobacco and Big Pharma have been taken to task in court for deception about the health risks of their products, and Big Oil is seemingly next. A number of states are suing the oil industry for its role in causing climate change and for allegedly working to block efforts to mitigate damage to the atmosphere over decades. New Jersey could soon join these states. State Senator Loretta Weinberg is co-sponsor of a resolution urging Governor Murphy and Attorney General Gurbir Graywal to pursue legal action against fossil fuel companies. Weinberg is a Democrat who represents the 37th District in New Jersey's State Senate, and welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Good morning, and thank you.
Sure. Let's begin by talking about the expense of climate change, Loretta. Scientists say we can expect more events like Superstorm Sandy, and that alone costs the state billions, right?
Well, yes, I think that with the exception of very few naysayers, that society is coming together to acknowledge that climate change is a huge problem and one that is going to involve some very big thoughts of how to ameliorate it. And I think your last guest closed his segment by saying that we really need to use our ingenuity, our ability, our understanding to start answering this problem in a very big way.
As we prepare for the possibility, the likelihood, actually, of more heat and more precipitation and more flooding, sea level rise, you say there's a real need to take a hard look at the state's infrastructure. Tell us about that.
At the state's infrastructure, yes. Well, first of all, we're seeing it today. We're getting all of these warnings about flooding from a tropical storm, not a hurricane, but a tropical storm that's working its way up the East Coast. And we see preparations against storm surge, against flooding. So we know that that is partially attributable to climate change. We know it's about where and how we are going to build and what areas we decide should not be built upon. So there is a much to be studying here and much to be legislating about.
So briefly, when we're talking about infrastructure, just focusing on that, we're talking about replacing water mains, we're talking about sewers, treatment facilities, roads, and beach replenishment, that sort of thing, Loretta?
Well, that's part of it, certainly. And a part of it, is when we talk about infrastructure, is to make sure we no longer build on areas that are that wetlands, that we need to ameliorate flooding, that we do not build in floodplains. So I think it's a combination of both of those things. Certainly, New Jersey is a mature state. It is our infrastructure is mature, whether we're talking about water mains and things of that nature that need to be replaced. We were talking about lead in our water supply, where our where youngsters are still getting lead poisoning, whether from water supplies or from old lead paint in apartment buildings that were built before the 70s. So again, this is a huge problem that demands solutions and cooperation between local, state, and county governments.
Okay, so I do want to get to, you know, the lawsuit, potential lawsuit against Big Oil, but briefly, we've got an email from Kyle who says, asks, has there been any discussion of updating building codes on a statewide basis to address climate change?
There has been. I've been engaged with a group about updating building codes, and we've been working on it. It's a long and very painful work in progress. And there are many special interest groups that become involved, whether they are builders or landlords or environmentalists. And yes, we are working on coming up with some new ideas to update our building codes, long overdue.
So State Senator Loretta Weinberg, why take on Big Oil?
Because they are partially responsible for what's gone on here in terms of fossil fuels. So this is a statement. I mean, a resolution, as you know, is not a law.
Yeah.
We are recommending to the governor and to the attorney general that they take a look at this. And as you said in your opening, like big tobacco, we feel that certainly big oil knew what was going on with the constant production of their fossil fuels. And we think they should be responsible for what that has done to our environment here. So it is a statement of we're here, join us, reduce it, and asking our state government to represent the residents of New Jersey and making sure that this gets stopped.
And also, too, as far as funding infrastructure preparation and et cetera, you know, it's going to cost a lot of money. The state has been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic to the tune of billions of dollars. If New Jersey were to join the others in suing Big Oil, potentially this could help mitigate some of the damage that you say Big Oil has done as far as climate change is concerned?
Well, certainly, as the state did with the with tobacco, not always to the best of its interest, the money can be leveraged. It can be used to help mitigate all the things you just outlined, whether you're talking about storm drains or water pipes or any of the large infrastructure needs in the state of New Jersey, and they are directly related. So I think it is a perfectly logical way, but to, you're a step ahead. First, there has to be willingness to join in such lawsuits and then see what the result might be.
Yeah, well, that, and that that's a big step ahead. Yes, the next question is, have you had any early indication from either Governor Murphy or Attorney General Grewal as to whether the state is interested or feels it can join this movement?
No, I have not had any direct discussions with the governor or with the Attorney General. Hopefully the bill will, the resolution will go up for a vote, hopefully in August. It came through the Environment Committee. And once it is passed by the Senate, I'm sure we will get an answer back from the governor's office.
Quickly, Loretta, we've got about 30 seconds left. Republican State Senator Kip Bateman is co-sponsor of this resolution. Are you seeing more of your colleagues across the aisle increasingly supportive of climate change initiatives?
Well, you know, I started out the segment by saying, with the exception of very few naysayers, I think people have finally come to the conclusion that climate change is a real and overriding problem. And I think having bipartisan support is an important step forward. This is not a Republican or a Democratic problem. If, in fact, climate change affects our future, it does so without respect to party affiliation.
Loretta Weinberg, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Loretta Weinberg is New Jersey State Senator representing the 37th District. Up next, we talk about pet care. Stay tuned. You're listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. When the pandemic first broke and people were urged to stay at home, animal shelters saw an unexpected and welcome surge in adoptions. So, nearly 5 months in, we're asking, how's it going? If you were among those taking a companion animal into your family, have they settled in? And if, by chance, you're heading back to the office anytime soon, how do you best prepare your pet for a significant change in routine? We're also taking any questions or comments about the adoption process, making a good match, tackling behavioral issues, and etc. Our number is 888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're joined now by Nancy Urban, shelter manager for the Animal Welfare Association of Voorhees, New Jersey. Great to have you with us, Nancy. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm excited to be here and talking to you guys today.
And we're glad to have you here because so many of us, I'm sure, including myself, have questions about our animal, companion animals. But first, you know, to the silver lining in the pandemic, again, an awful lot of animals have found homes, including many who are usually tougher to place. Nancy, are you still seeing a higher than average number of adoptions?
Absolutely. It has been unbelievable. I mean, definitely something that's unprecedented. We've never seen before. The outpouring of support, folks willing to open up their homes and their hearts to animals has been incredible. We normally... The boost in not only adoptions, but also those willing to do it on a foster basis as well. So it's just been amazing the amount of support that we've gotten.
What are some of the most common challenges pet owners face when trying to acclimate a new animal into the home?
Gosh, pre-COVID, the acclimation was probably much more difficult because you're looking for a dog or, you know, a pet that's going to fit into your busy schedule. So, you know, and the challenge is to carve out that time just for that pet. And I think that's what has been the biggest probably change, is that people now are home more. You know, there's no Johnny has softball, Joey has soccer, we've got to run here, there, everywhere. People are home. So they're giving those animals the time that they need to acclimate. And it's a much less stressful household in terms of time commitment. So the animals are getting the time, the training, and they're being put on a schedule right off the bat. And I think that's really seeing a huge, huge change in how they're being welcomed into as part of the family right off the bat. People are really investing that time.
You told our producer, John Ahrens, that the return rate has been basically non-existent. Is that because people are essentially home to work with their companion animals?
I believe so. And they're taking advantage of the programs that we have in place. So if someone's having, you know, a difficult time, let's say housebreaking a puppy that they've just adopted, we have a behavior department that will work with them and help them through it. So it's not you adopt the dog and bye, we you know, don't see you again or don't hear from you again. We want to be an integral part of making that adoption successful. So we have other, you know, services in place that can allow for that. So yeah, the return rate during COVID, I think it has been, honestly, on an average month, we might see like 5 returns. Now we're seeing 0.
Hmm. Oh, that's wonderful
crazy
news. I'm sure it's wonderful news. So
yeah.
Nancy, if and when a person is heading back to work, how do you prepare the dog that's been enjoying undivided attention for the past few months? And how do things have to change within the family?
Well, there's the old saying that a good dog is a tired dog. So making sure that the animal is exercised both physically and mentally. So yes, you can take care of the physical part of it, you know, maybe a longer morning walk before you head out the door to go to work, but also make sure that pet has something to do to occupy their mind during the time that you're away. So there's a lot of interesting things that you can do with that. There's food puzzles or things we call enrichment here at the shelter. So that could be a Kong stuffed with peanut butter and maybe some kibble that they have to work at. So it gives them something to do throughout the day. So making sure that they have those other opportunities. You can also have, you know, work out a system maybe with a neighbor or a pet sitter where they come and let your dog out. If housebreaking is still, you know, a work in progress, you don't want to, you know, have a setback there. So, you know, maybe work with a friend, family member, or a pet sitter to come in and help alleviate some of that as well. But I think just getting onto a schedule and sticking to that schedule is going to be the most important thing to be successful when returning to work.
And maybe even trying that a couple weeks in advance, getting to that schedule so the dog gets used to it before you head out the door.
Exactly. If it's a matter of, you know, the animal's going to be crated while you're out, you know, make sure they have plenty of things to do while they're in that crate. If they're not crated, you know, again, making sure they have other things to do. But you can go out for a few hours, like you said, come back and check everything's good. They seem happy and content. Then, you know, you're on the right page with what you're doing to enrich their time during the day.
Okay. We're getting calls and comments into 888-477-9499 or Radio Times at whyy.org is our email. Let's go to Sophia in Philly. Welcome to the Regional Roundup, Sophia.
Hi.
Hi. So what's your question or comment?
We have a new puppy as well, and we're trying to stick to a schedule and sort of train and teach her all of the things that will happen once we're no longer working from home. But we are finding that she is very sad when she's in the crate, which doesn't prevent us from crate training, but we are wondering, is there a time that's too early or a puppy that's too young for that, and what are sort of the limits or signs that we should notice for when we are doing it wrong or hurting our cause more than helping it.
Okay, Nancy?
Did you say she was very sad or very bad in the
very
crate?
Sad.
Bad.
Sad, yeah.
Okay. So what? The one thing that you always want to make sure that the crate is only used for positive things. So it's never a punishment or a timeout. And you want to make every time she goes into that crate, you know, associate it with something positive. So a treat that she only gets when she's in the crate, a Kong that she only gets when she's in that crate. So you want to make the association with it a positive thing. And you can start crate training, I mean, right from the get-go, as soon as you acquire the puppy. And you also, just like children, you kind of don't want to give in to, you know, the puppy that whines and cries because they're in the crate. Because then, again, if you take them out, that's telling them that what they're doing is right and you're rewarding that behavior. So, you know, making the crate a pleasant experience. And again, depending on how long you're out of the house, you know, I know some people's work schedules, you know, mine included, I'm out of the house 12 hours a day, but I have someone that is home, you know, after about 6 hours that my husband can stop in, let the dogs out. So they have, you know, a few minutes in the backyard before, you know, I come home later on. So trying to arrange that. You don't want the dog to be in there. I would say if it's a puppy and you're working on housebreaking, a puppy's bladder cannot hold for 8 to 10 hours. You know, you're going to want to cut that somewhere around 4 to 6 hours and have someone come in, let them out, you know, so that way they can do their, you know, what they need to do and still maintain a clean environment in the crate.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call, Sophia. How do you, if you are thinking about adopting an animal, Nancy, how do you make a good match? What do you need to be thinking about walking through the doors of the animal shelter?
The best thing to think about, I know everyone wants to, you know, fall in love. They see what they see and it's that connection everyone's looking for. But also think about your lifestyle. You know, what is it that you're looking for, you know, with a pet? Some people just want that, you know, that couch potato buddy to watch Wheel of Fortune with. Other people want that hiking buddy because they're going to be outdoors. Some people want a jogging partner. So kind of think about what it is for your expectation and then look for a pet that's going to match that. Don't always go by looks alone, because we could all be drawn into a beautiful Australian Shepherd, you know, who's got the beautiful Merle markings and such a gorgeous coat and a sweet disposition. But we also have to know that they have needs that need to be met as well. So
yeah, they're
you know,
high energy dogs.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So if you want the couch potato buddy, that's not necessarily going to be the breed of dog you're looking for, unless, of course, maybe it's a senior dog. So kind of, you know, keep your options open, as well as keep yourself educated on the different breeds and, you know, talk to the staff at the shelter and ask what their experiences are with those dogs. You know, are they high energy, or, you know, who could you point me to that might fit? This is what I'm looking for. So really, you know, talk up the staff, because they're the experts on the animals that are in their care day in and day out.
Animals can be good companions for very young children, but as you know, we parents well know, little kids can be impulsive and, you know, even grabby. They don't really know what they're doing and can unintentionally get into trouble with an animal, maybe risk being bitten or scratched. What are some of the parameters you'd like to see in place if a family with young kids is adopting?
The most important thing is, you know, no different than if you have a playdate. You know, another child coming over the house, you're going to make sure you're there to supervise and make sure no one gets into trouble. And, you know, the new friend isn't too rough with your child. Same thing with a pet. You know, you're going to bring in that new pet. Supervision is key to success. You know, you want to make sure the new pet, whether it be a cat or a puppy, are appropriate with your child and the child is appropriate with the pet. That's going to be your key to success. That and again, just like getting a child on a schedule, you know, the same thing with the pet. Get the pet on a schedule. Those are your two things for success.
Okay. You also adopt out animals other than dogs and cats. What are some of the more unusual animals you've lined up at the or had up for adoption at the Animal Welfare Association?
In the past couple of months, we've done rabbits and guinea pigs. Those are usually our most popular small animals. The guinea pigs, it's kind of cute. People just love them. They come in and they adopt them either singly or in pairs. If we get them in little bonded duos, we will keep them together moving forward to their new home. So those are probably the two most popular pets.
Why do they come into why do they end up in the shelter in the first place? What is it people should know about having them as part of the family as far as care is concerned?
As far as care, they actually, to me, the small animals take as much work, if not more, than a dog.
How so?
You know, they have to have an enclosure that is enriching to their lives. They need specialized diets, so a lot of fruits and vegetables. So, you know, not just going to the store and buying a bag of pellets, but they need hay. They need the vitamins that come from those fresh fruits and vegetables to ensure that they have a nice, long, healthy life. We get the small animals from a variety of sources. We work in connection with a lot of the shelters in the area that don't necessarily do small animal adoptions. So so we'll pull their small animals here and put them up for adoption. And we also take owner surrenders as well. So when folks get those small animals thinking it's going to be something that, you know, children are going to learn responsibility with, and, you know, the kids promise everything, and then 6 months into it, nobody's playing with the pet anymore.
Sure.
That's generally where we see it as well, where people reach out to us and we take them in.
What is the best way to introduce an animal to those you already have at home?
The key to success there is, well, if we start off, because every species is different, but I would say with dogs, to make sure that the new dog that you're bringing home, that you're introducing it to the resident dog on neutral property. You know, you don't want to bring that new dog into the resident dog's home and just expect that automatically they're going to share everything and get along wonderfully.
Yeah.
You want to, you know, take them for a walk around the block. Let them get to know each other's scent first. Then you're going to take them into the backyard. Again, let the leashes drag. Just heaven forbid there's any scuffles. You can just pick up leashes to pull them apart. You don't have to get your hands in the middle. And just watch for you know, what the dogs are telling you. Are their tails being held high and stiff? That's showing that they're uncomfortable. Or are they low and slowly wagging? That's going to show that they're more at ease with the situation and what's going on. So really to pay attention to the signs that they're telling you. And if something makes you uncomfortable or unsure, to reach out to a professional, a trainer, to go, you know, with how to proceed from there.
Is a biting dog necessarily one that's beyond redemption, Nancy? I'm not talking about a puppy who's being mouthy.
It really depends on a variety of issues and factors taking into account. So, you know, what were the circumstances surrounding the bite? What is the dog's history prior to that incident? You know, it's really on a case-by-case basis as far as, you know, rehabilitation.
And so, you know, training a pup not to be mouthy is probably a good way to forestall biting behavior down the road. Best practices here?
Correct. Start young and start right off the bat. You know, everybody loves the honeymoon period when you take home the new pet and everything's lovely and, oh, we're going to let them snuggle on the couch. And then 2 weeks into it, it's like, you know, I really don't want that animal on the couch. And then you try to lay down the law. The animal is now totally confused. So if you're going to, you know, start off on the right foot, put those schedules and rules into place right from the get-go and continue with them. That way there's no confusion. The animal knows right up front, you know, what the expectations are.
Where does fostering come into the picture? And I understand, I had inquired about it, you know, a while ago when I had some time. I was told it's not a trial run, you know, if you're thinking about adopting an animal, correct? You don't go into it with
correct.
That mindset. Tell us about
correct.
That.
Fostering is, I mean, such a huge part of our organization. Without our fosters, we could not do the life-saving work that we do. Currently, we have over 200 foster families in our system, and they help us save probably close to 1,000 lives a year.
Hmm.
And these are our families or individuals that have gone through training with us, and now because of COVID, we've learned how to do virtual training. So we're able to offer training much more frequently and at more convenient times for people. So these fosters that sign up for us, and they can sign up to say, you know, their only interest is fostering kittens, or their only interest is fostering, you know, adult dogs. Whatever their interest is, we will put them in that slot, so to speak. And then as the need comes up, we will reach out to them. We have a foster Facebook page that we are in constant communication with our fosters through, as well as through an email system to let them know what's in need of foster. So they would make that commitment if they decide, you know, hey, I see you guys need a foster for a litter of kittens. I'm interested. Sign me up. We will have them come in. They pick up the kittens. They get on a schedule where every 2 weeks they come back with those kittens. For vaccinations, dewormings, all preventative care.
All right, hey, Nancy, unfortunately, we are out of time. I'm going to have to stop you there.
Goodness, I'm sorry.
No, don't be. I just was listening and I lost track of the time myself. Listen, you're with the Animal Welfare Association of Voorhees, New Jersey. More information on your website, I'm sure. Nancy Urban is shelter manager. So good to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Okay. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. John Ahrens is producer for the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us. And be well.